So I will begin by acknowledging we're on Wurundjeri country of the people of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to the elders past and present. It's lovely to have Aunty Di here this morning to welcome us. I spend quite a bit of time on country here in Melbourne, so it's always lovely to be welcomed by an elder. It never fails to be a moving experience. I'm going to try and remember what... one of the things I think I was reminded of this morning was that I'm always really glad to be able to speak to people about learning and teaching, but one of the things that our elders remind us is that this is country on which learning has taken place for many thousands of years. So what we talk about today in terms of Indigenous studies and teaching, Indigenous student learning, is really part of a continuum of learning that has taken place over many thousands of years. This is not new necessarily, it's new kind of now, the sorts of things we might be talking about, but learning and teaching is not. Okay, that's my little bit. Thanks to Christine, who's just gone out for trust me to, yeah, rocked, okay, let's party now. No, it's always nice to be asked to come and speak at these things, so I'm always very grateful. It's all right. Christine's right. I have been researching and teaching in the Indigenous higher ed sphere for probably, more than 10 years now, and probably just less than 20. So I was obviously very young when I started out, because I'm still a girl. But so what I'm going to talk to you today about is some of my doctoral work, but also I guess it draws on the experience that I've had over that period of time and the thinking that I've done. And it's also informed by my history as an Aboriginal woman. As I think Joanne put that really nicely, we probably don't even think about that sometimes in the ways in which our Aboriginality, contributes to our work. So that's a little bit about me. Let's move on now because I'm much happier talking about other things. So today, we know that Indigenous studies, and I'm going to use Indigenous studies and Indigenous teaching somewhat interchangeably here at the moment, and for my purposes it actually doesn't matter, but we know that teaching Indigenous studies can be really exciting. I know it's just after lunch and I know that you can all tap into that excitement that you feel in teaching. I can feel it here, but maybe that was just lunch. No, it can be really exciting. I think we think we're doing really good work, and often we are doing really good work. But it also can be challenging, and I think Katrina and Kathy's presentation did kind of bring some of those issues to the fore, particularly for Indigenous teachers, but I imagine that non-Indigenous teachers also catch a bit of that flack from students along the way. So what I'm going to be talking about today is what I think that we can harness learning theory to try and help us understand those challenges a little better and to help us understand in particular how students learn. So actually I've sort of departed a little bit from teaching, but it comes back full circle eventually. But how students learn and how we might begin to build an evidence base around how we do that teaching and helping our students to learn. Okay, so I am going to be today talking about using the threshold concepts framework, and I will explain that in more detail if you're not familiar with threshold concepts framework, and frankly I don't expect everybody is, or even many of you are. So I'm going to be talking about this is a framework first conceptualised by Meyer and Land, and how we might use that to gather some evidence in Indigenous studies. All right, that's the first slide gone. So this is just a brief outline, probably roughly in this order, the presentation today. So talking about using evidence to enhance teaching, identifying a teaching problem, I'm going to get you to help me with that. And then I'll talk at a little bit of length about the threshold concepts framework. And somewhere in there, somewhere in the beginning and somewhere towards the end, I'm going to talk about reconceptualising and rethinking our classroom space. Now, because it's after lunch, there are some sort of coloured slides in here, and there are a couple of diagrams in particular that have got colours and shapes in them which actually have no meaning whatsoever to the schema. So just bear that in mind, but I've made them nice and bright so that you'll stay awake, and we do have a couple of activities. Hopefully, I can actually see you, so I can see if you've gone to sleep, and I also can see if you're checking your emails. I know, multitasking. Okay, so Christine's gathered us here today, sort of like a wedding, right? She's gathered us here today to talk about evidence. In a sense, though, if we think about it, we're surrounded in higher education, in our teaching in particular, we are surrounded by what you might kind of consider is an invisible, what do I call it, an invisible evidence base. There's a kind of a structure around us that we almost take for granted these days. It's an invisible infrastructure. So, for example, we're probably most of us doing things like early assessments. We're mostly probably lining up our learning objectives with our assessments, with our teaching, mostly, let's hope, anyway. If you're here today, probably you definitely are doing that kind of thing. We don't necessarily have to know that that's called constructive alignment. We don't necessarily have to know that Biggs might have been the person who thought about that and bothered to write it down. It's there. It's in the kinds of the policies that are in universities that guide us. So we're surrounded by this invisible evidence, or this invisible evidence base. Ference Martin's work in deep and surface learning, for example, seems to have really kind of popular currency, and probably we've shifted in our thinking a long way from the work that he originally might have done, but it seems to still have quite a lot of currency. So we've got an evidence base around us. Even if we don't know that, we definitely have. Okay. Some of the other evidence we have, we gather from, and Katrina and Kathy have helpfully, something to build on, ladies, thank you very much, have talked to us about, gathering student evaluative data. We probably all do that for, good reasons. It helps our teaching. It also hopefully helps our promotion, those sorts of things. But we have less evidence, it seems to me, around how our students learn, particularly in Indigenous studies. So we know about how students, we know lots of stuff about how students learn. I don't necessarily probably need to go into that, but Prosser and Trigg, all sorts of work that we know around how students learn in general. We don't have a lot of evidence, though, around how students might learn in Indigenous studies. And the question of embedding Indigenous perspectives in the disciplines came up in my working group just before lunch. There's not a lot of evidence around what will work there. And it seems to me, and I have to say, I will just declare my hand, I guess I am somewhat of an empiricist at heart, and that might put me at somewhat at odds with some of my colleagues, but I do think that we need to have evidence. We need to understand what is going to work and what will work well. And we need to gather this from some kind of research. It's one of the research in our teaching is one of the pillars of the scholarship of teaching and learning. We need to be developing and building that and doing the work. And so I've struck out, and that's what I'm going to be doing, is doing some of that work. Ian reminded us this morning, I think, of why that's important, because student learning is always important and because we need good outcomes in our classrooms and those kinds of things. But it seems to me that Ian reminded us of another reason why that is important, in that the Berendt Review drew attention to the role of universities in equipping non-Indigenous people particularly to be able to, work better with our Indigenous communities, particularly around, the professions. But I think more broadly we need to be able to equip all of our graduates, in understanding and working with Indigenous people. Many of our university graduates will make decisions that will affect Indigenous people, whether they're working in a remote community in some, sort of exotic location, or whether they're working for, DET or Centrelink, for example. So all of those people, I think, do need to have an understanding. Graduate attributes is something Christine's been working on, around graduate attributes in Indigenous something for all graduates. I'm not going to talk about that today, but just to remind us that is the end point of why learning in this space is really important, particularly in Indigenous studies. We're often teaching non-Indigenous students, and it's really important work because they will impact upon Indigenous people probably at some time. Okay. All right. One of the other things that the review drew our attention to was the work of Bierman and Townsend Cross, who said that this is a really under-theorised area. So there's scope for work to be done. All right. First wake-up call. Okay. There's a prize for the person who can figure out how this relates to the conversation today. No, there's not actually. somewhere in The Sound of Music, which probably, just from those little giggles, most of you seem to be familiar with, somewhere in The Sound of Music, Julie Andrews, or Maria as she was, sang a song that sound, and I'm not going to sing, so don't worry. Although if somebody would like to sing, the song that goes, let's start at the very beginning. It's a very good place to start. And actually, that's really sensible logic, isn't it, to start at the beginning? I mean, I guess you can start at the end too. You can start anywhere you like, particularly if you've got a circle. But starting at the beginning seems really logical. However, when we're teaching, it's too often well after the beginning that we realise we've got a problem. You know where you begin, and I think Kathy and Katrina alluded to this morning. You've got a finite semester, 13, 14 weeks, maybe 10 or 11, depending on how many reading weeks you're giving. You know, you've got a finite period of time. It's often not until you get a little way into that period, though, that you realise you've got a problem. Maybe when the first assessments come in, students start to do their first presentations, and you sort of think, ooh, they're not quite with me, or, you know, they're doing presentations that are quite shallow and simplistic. They're not really what you would like to see. So for me, and I guess some of the things I'm going to talk about today, hopefully you will all recognise. And whilst we sometimes get into our teaching and we see the problems and we think, oh, I wish, you know, I wonder what I could do to make that better. And often we do things like we'll jiggle with the assessment. People do that, you know, fiddle with the assessment. I need to, you know, I'll change my assessment. Or I'll change the curriculum around a little bit to see if I can, you know, have the students thinking better, doing whatever it is that I want them to do. What's the third thing that you can often do? And you adjust your teaching. You know, maybe you do a different kind of style of teaching here or there, but we tend to fiddle perhaps around the edges of things. That's usually because we don't have a lot of time on our hands to think and to really figure out, okay, what is the problem? Take a deep breath and step back. Luckily, at the moment, I'm on study leave, so I do have a little bit of time to step back. So, yeah. And reflect. And I guess I've been reflecting on my teaching over the years and the sorts of things that I see students time and time again do in Indigenous studies that I wish they wouldn't, and I wish that things would be better. And we'll come to those what those things are in a moment. Okay, so, and maybe I guess I want to suggest that partly the problem may not be in any of those things, or not in any one of those things, but it might be in how we conceptualise our teaching and how we conceptualise particular student behaviours that we see. That'll make sense again in a moment. But to start with, I want to have a look at our classrooms and just... Oh, yeah, this is the colours and colour and movement. To suggest that we have quite complex classrooms, that might sound really silly to say that, but by the time you get to the last little bubble that comes up, maybe you'll see the classroom a little differently, I hope. So in any classroom, hopefully, we've often got a teacher. Even if it's an online classroom, we've got a teacher. Teacher's got a lot going on generally. Thank you again to Katrina and Kathy for introducing Brookfield's four lenses. So I just remind you, if I can remember, Brookfield's four lenses are, so as teachers, we bring our own autobiographies, the learnings that we've had, well, often the teaching that we've had. So we bring our memories and understandings of that to our classrooms, the perceptions that our students have, or we think the perceptions that the students have of us. What are the other two? Our colleagues, so what our colleagues might say to us, what we talk to our colleagues about. You know, you might go into the tea room and say, oh gosh, this happened and I wonder what, and then colleagues might suggest what they can do, that kind of community of practice thing. And then the evidence and the research, okay, which is the real focus here. So teachers got, you know, that sort of thinking about those things. Teachers also bring their own life experience, and I think this is, again, you could have just done the presentation this morning, ladies, but one of the things we was raised this morning was around Indigenous teachers, particularly the stresses that come from teaching Indigenous studies. And those life experiences, our Indigenous teachers definitely bring into the classroom. We bring our cultural heritages into the classroom. Might be a good if I have to give up. And of course, we bring our discipline knowledge. We bring
Most of us teaching in Indigenous Studies have a discipline background other than Indigenous Studies, except the lucky few who have done qualifications in Indigenous Studies. So there's a whole lot going on with the teacher and a lot of things that we're thinking about. There's probably a whole bunch of other things that you can think of there as well. And our students have also got a whole lot of things going on. So they've got the effect of their peers, you know, what are their peers saying about, you know, Indigenous things, their own learning styles, how do they learn best, their own cultures. As I've said, in my experience, many of the students doing Indigenous Studies are non-Indigenous, but we have Indigenous students and all students have culture. Their family influences, and this one probably I think is particularly an issue in Indigenous Studies, the things that students have learned in school or not learned in school, I think are really, those things come into the classroom. Now, so I just want to begin with the complex classroom. Hold on to that thought, if you can bear to hold on to those colours and shapes, because I'm going to come back to that and add a little more complexity to it, believe it or not. I'll just make sure I've done what I wanted. Yeah, okay. Okay. All right, I'll just revisit. So I just want to revisit again why bother with evidence. So Ian did a great job of telling us that in the big picture policy stuff. But Brookfield says, and I think this is more about us as teachers in the classroom. I'll let you read that. I don't need to read that out. Give you a moment. Okay, there's a couple of things that I just want to underline about what Brookfield's saying here is, I want you to just hold on to this idea of difficult, threatening and exhilarating, but particularly the difficult and threatening. But the point, I guess, he's making here is that we need to know what students' understandings of their learnings are. We need to understand how students are learning. All right. And without that, it's really hard for us to teach. I think, what did I say here? So, to date, much of the understanding we have about our student learning is from their assessments, is from, you know, the things that students say in class, for example, the trial and error that we have when we're teaching in our classrooms. We know less from a research point of view. We do know some things about diversity learning, for example, Pascarella and Terenzini's work on the effects on student cognition of all students having a diversity experience. So we do know some about that, but that's very broad, big picture kind of research. And it seems to me that we can't teach from intuition alone, although honestly our experiences and the intuitions that we have and the knowledge that we've built up over years is important, but we can't teach from intuition alone, or simply from the skills that we've developed in our disciplinary knowledge. Hopefully you've now believe me when I say we need evidence. Did I get the evidence stuff? Yeah. All right. Now, so I've got a little activity now. I want to refocus us on Indigenous Studies. I've been working on another project and there's been a big discussion around what Indigenous Studies is, and so I've just put a little definition there for you. It's really just to kind of focus this. Definitely don't want to tear that apart right now. So I want you to have a think about, what do you expect a student to be able to do after completing an Indigenous Studies unit? So what are your hopes, dreams, your aspirations after they've finished a unit? If you're not teaching a whole unit, think about it in terms of when you're teaching your embedded material, whatever it is that you're teaching. So first of all, it's all going to come up at once. So just consider that in relation to your own teaching. So take a minute and consider that in relation to your own teaching. Then you can turn to the person next to you and tell them what your hopes and dreams are, and then we'll share some ideas back. Thank you. So the sorts of responses we've had, though, talk not so much about content, but they talk about values, ideas, things that we want people to be able to do, attitudes changing and transforming. This is
Which is terrific. That's fantastic. I would probably defy any teacher to suggest that that's not what they wanted from their students, you know, those kinds of ideal things. These are some of the things I hear teachers say, and certainly some of the things that I have said myself, having taught in Indigenous Studies classrooms. And I'm not going to apologise right at the moment for the fact that these are all quite negative. That's meant to be like that. I'm hoping I'll get Maria singing again at the end and it won't seem quite so negative. But these are some of the kinds of things. Now, obviously not all students are like this, but I did... thank you again, Katrina and Kathy. I saw the word regurgitation in one of your... Yeah, in one of your slides. All right. It seems to me that often we all have great students in our classes. They probably would work it out, however, whatever you did with them in the classroom. But it seems to me often that there's too big a group of students who just don't seem to get it. I see very oversimplified binary kind of thinking around black and white, them and us. And again, ladies, thank you. I think you raised that again this morning. You know, I see quite simplified thinking, and that doesn't help students to understand what I think is a very complex domain of Indigenous studies. It doesn't help them to get at why there is a gap today in Indigenous health. Why do those things happen? Those simple binaries don't help the students to think that through. Okay, so some of what we're seeing, some of what the things that the students do is they do regurgitate, they mimic, they tell us what they think they want us to hear. Did I say that right? You know what I mean. In our less charitable moments, and maybe none of you are less charitable, but I am sometimes. In my less charitable moments, let's just call that for what it is, I sometimes think, you know, are these students lazy? They haven't bothered to do the reading? You know, are they just completely disengaged? You know, it's not my teaching. It's not anything I've done wrong. They're just, you know, it's the students' fault. But I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about threshold concepts in a moment, and in fact I've come to a realisation that maybe if I were a little more charitable I might see that kind of mimicking, regurgitation-y kind of stuff and some of the ambivalence that students feel, we might see that a little bit differently, and in fact I might work with that a bit differently. Okay, and so some of this idea about oversimplification led me to think about threshold concepts. I went to a conference a couple of years ago and heard Ray Land talk about threshold concepts, and it seemed like a really good idea to me. Any luck, it'll seem like a good idea to you. So a threshold concept, and I'll let you read that. So a threshold concept represents a transformed way of understanding things. So that transformation is implied in developing understandings of threshold concepts. It's learning knowledge that students they can't learn the discipline well without. And it can happen in any discipline. I'm just happening to locate it here in Indigenous Studies. And without those conceptual understandings, students will be... they'll be stunted at the level of thinking very simply in those kind of binary sorts of ways or just really not getting it. Okay, so indeed, threshold concepts, and I'm going to tell you what, give you some examples in a moment. Threshold concepts are about pennies dropping, epiphanies, those kinds of things. They're about, and you maybe can remember, I can certainly remember as an undergraduate having those kinds of moments where things like, oh, yep, okay, that makes more sense. And so... There are five key characteristics of a concept that might be a threshold concept, that it helps to integrate understanding so that you can connect up things in whatever discipline it might be. So this piece of understanding leads you to understand the rest of the discipline better, and I will explain this a bit more. It is bounded though, it doesn't kind of open everything up, but it opens up a portion of the knowledge and then leads you to another place where there might be another threshold. They're irreversible. Usually once the students get an idea, whatever that idea might be, once they get it, it's really hard for them to go back on it. Sometimes they might wax and wane, but usually they don't go back. They're transformative. The students start to think in different ways once they've got the threshold concept. But, and here's the really interesting bit, they're often troublesome.
So that stuff that Brookfield was saying about, you know, struggling and you know, being threatened and scared, and some of the stuff that Katrina's students were saying and Kathy's students were saying, it can be troublesome getting these concepts. All right, now, let me just quickly... Oh, Myron Land, sorry. Thank you, Myron Land. Okay, so I want to just do a quick activity, very quick activity, a quick activity to demonstrate a threshold concept. And this is, again, partly to keep you awake, but it's the one that Myer and Land use, generally, like their first introduction to threshold concepts. And thank you to Velvet Underground for the name of the activity. But what I would like you to do is tell me, how can I cool these cups of tea down? We'll have afternoon to see you soon. Anybody have any idea how we'll cool the tea down?
Add milk.
Sorry?
Add milk.
Yes, add milk, of course. That's the most obvious thing, isn't it? Hot milk? Cold milk?
I don't know physics.
Good. You are going to be my friend, Tracy, because I don't either. I'm about to go where I probably shouldn't go. Okay, just imagine that I poured the first cup of tea now, 12 o'clock or now, and a few minutes later I put some milk. So I put milk in the first one, and then a few minutes later I put milk in the second one. That's the bottom one. Which of those cups is going to cool quickest? And if you actually really know the answer from physics, don't tell everybody. I was gambling here. I'll give you 2 seconds. The bottom one? Why?
Just from experience in the kitchen, really.
Good. Yes, experience in the kitchen. Good. Anybody else? No? Nah? Well, frankly, I didn't know which one, and I'm still not. I hope I can explain to you. It is the bottom one, apparently, and I'm going to read here. So they say, intuitively, you might think it's the first cup will be cooler, but it's actually the second cup because in the initial stages of cooling, it is hotter than the first cup. The second cup is hotter than the first cup, and therefore it loses more heat because of the steeper temperature gradient. You got it now?
Yeah.
I think I need to go home because I'm not sure I could explain that to anybody if I had to. All right, the point is not whether I can understand that. The point is that Myron Lamb were trying to make with this particular exercise is that once the threshold concept here is temperature gradient, the change in the temperature gradient, which if you're a chef, for example, if you don't learn that, if you just, this kind of assumed knowledge, if you don't learn that and you don't get that, it's really hard to cook well because you don't understand about the, you know, the temperature of pots and pans, for example. So once chefs understand this change in temperature gradient, and maybe that's why we're supposed to use those copper bottom pans or something, but they can then think really differently about, you know, will they use this pan? What does the heat need to be at? It's not just about chucking a whole lot of ingredients in a pan. I can think really differently about it. Or so Myron Land reckon. One of the things about threshold concepts is that they're often counterintuitive. And honestly, you guys all said you got that first time round. For me, it's still somewhat counterintuitive. I couldn't explain about that temperature gradient thing. Often these, your threshold concepts are things that that involve alien knowledge or that are counterintuitive to students. And I think probably if you think about it when you go home, you might see that there's a bit of that going on in our Indigenous Studies classrooms, that we're trying to teach them things that are just not quite intuitive or definitely sometimes counterintuitive. So what they say happens, what Myron Lance say happens to students in this space is that before they get the threshold concept, just see what the next slide is, that they're in a thing called, what they call, there's just a couple of, I'm not going to go into those, but those are some established threshold concepts. Oh, we're going to go past that one. They say that students end up in where that troublesomeness happens, the struggle, the misunderstanding, the mimicry kinds of things happen in this space here, which they call the liminal space. And Christine very kindly said limen is something, yes, is threshold in Latin. That must have been missing from my education.
So there's this liminal space here where students are struggling. And some of the things that we're seeing in our classrooms that look like lazy behaviour or disengagement or mimicking, in fact, sometimes plagiarism maybe, is probably the struggle that's going on in that space. It's one of the things they do to... So what they're doing is attempting mastery. They oscillate sometimes between the old and new learnings, but hopefully they eventually get the new learnings. Their learnings in that space are both affective, so it affects their emotions sometimes, and certainly in Indigenous studies, it would be not uncommon to hear teachers talk about students' guilt, those kinds of things. It's definitely an affective domain for the students. But it's also cognitive. They are trying to learn, you know, they're trying to draw on their previous experience. They're trying to, you know, they're trying to assimilate new things into their current schema, those kinds of things. And they may struggle there. And sometimes they are unsafe journeys. So the students really do feel anxious in that space. I'm not getting it. I don't know it. I thought I had it and now I don't. It's lost to me. So this leads us to the teaching or the instructional problem is what might we do to help students negotiate the liminal space? Okay. And I'm nearly there, Christine. Okay, I'm going to go back to our complex classrooms and suggest that there's a couple more things missing here, or a couple more things we can add. Okay, so hopefully you're all vaguely familiar at least with Martin Nakita's work on the cultural interface, and I'm really sorry if you're not because I haven't got time to explain it, but essentially... and maybe it would be hard to explain anyway, but essentially Martin Nakita suggests that there's, between sort of Western and Indigenous knowledge, there's a space, I can't do it without doing hands, there's a space where there's a whole complex set of interrelations going on. And it seems to me in our classrooms that it is essentially a cultural interface. And on top of that, we have the students with their liminal space. So we have multiple kind of spaces going on. The students struggling in their liminal space. We've got a cultural interface space, which is complicated and complex as well. Yeah? Am I convincing you that it's a complex space, our classrooms? All right. So I am almost finished, Christine. So that's all very well to pose a problem and to, you know, I'll briefly say that the project that I'm undertaking or undertaking at the moment will look to determine what might be the threshold concepts in Indigenous studies. So you could probably all have a guess at some of them. I've had a guess at them. I've got a little list, but I don't actually want to share them with you at the moment. But I think understanding what those threshold concepts are, what they are in Indigenous studies, may in fact help us to get the students through this liminal space and get them onto the other side, to thinking more complexly, thinking more critically, to being able to do and be transformed and do the things that we want them to do. All right, so I'm going to set about trying to identify what they are. I'll just go back to mimicry, though, to end. I think one thing that we might be able to usefully do in relation to this issue of mimicry is something related to Vygotsky's work of the zone of proximal development. And I'm, for those of you nodding, that's great. For those of you not nodding, I'm going to do the very lay version. So essentially this work suggests that, you know, if you assist students and work with them today, they will be able to do it for themselves tomorrow. That's a very distilled version for that person who was nodding about Vygotsky. Apologies for oversimplifying that completely, but essentially what we might do in our classrooms is, and I think that might be just about it. Oh, I've got some taking measures. What we might do in our classrooms is help our students to work with that in that liminal space, to help them to understand that not getting it is okay, but we need to help them to get it. We need to accept that maybe that, you know, the mimicking is not a bad thing. I must say I've always thought that kind of, I see student assignments too many times that sort of are regurgitated. They're just sort of, they don't have any life in them. That may not be as bad as I think. Or maybe. And maybe there are ways that we can work with that and not just attribute it to sort of lazy students or the fact that we can't teach or whatever we might attribute it to. All right, so in the less than 2 minutes that I've got, I'll just give you some brief take-home messages, and I'm happy to give my presentation to anybody who might be vaguely interested. So I think that gathering evidence about student learning can be good for our teaching. I think understanding what those threshold concepts are, particularly in first-year Indigenous study, could be really helpful. If we can, first-year Indigenous studies, if we understand what the concepts are that the students struggle with, then we can teach to it. We focus much too much on content, and again, the ladies alluded to that this morning. We're often fixed on content, and we think not as much as we should about process. Maybe understanding what those threshold concepts are will help us to do that, will help us to help students to learn better and us to teach better. All right. Yeah, mimicry might not be so bad. Understanding where the students get stuck. So if we understand what the threshold is, we can understand where they get stuck, what they get stuck on, and just recognise and work with the complexity of our classrooms. So maybe the resistance, I wonder. I don't have this at all well conceptualised at the moment, but I reckon there's probably some work we can do about resistance. Maybe some of that resistance is not just pig-headed, bloody-minded students. It's part of this being stuck and not understanding and not feeling, having counterintuitive information brought to students' attention. I don't know that. I'm struggling. I'm, mulling that over at the moment.